Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Amanda Agati, Chief Investment Officer at PNC Financial Services Group. Amanda is responsible for the firm's overall investment strategy, portfolio and risk management functions, investment solutions, and the development and execution of investment policies for the asset management group at PNC. The last number that I saw cited was that the asset management group had $180-ish billion as of the third quarter of 2021. So Amanda is overseeing quite a book of assets. This conversation is more broad than it is deep, given Amanda's role. It was super fun to talk to her. I have enjoyed getting to know her, and hopefully she'll come back on the pod sometime. This episode is sponsored by Bastier Partners, a boutique investment bank. Bastier's founder and managing member is Nader Afshar, fan of the pod. Nader is described as a connector, high integrity, a low-key version of Byron Trott, and the rare investment banker that focuses on the alignment of interests and incentives. I appreciate him allowing me to do some due diligence on him and his firm, and I appreciate Bastier's support. As always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence. And with that out of the way, I hope you enjoy the episode. Thrilled to be joined by Amanda Agati. It's Agati, right?
It is, yes.
There you go. Good. I'm glad I didn't blow that right out of the gate.
Me too.
Yeah, would have been a terrible way to start.
Right.
Do you want to tell people a little bit of your background and you know, what you do at PNC?
Sure. So I am PNC's Chief Investment Officer. And what that means is I'm responsible for the entire investment offering for PNC's asset management business. We have about $180 billion in assets under management as of the end of the quarter, certainly subject to some market fluctuation here for sure. But in this capacity, in terms of asset management, we serve a number of different client segments. And so we service family offices, ultra high net worth individuals, and institutions. So it really runs the gamut. I always say it takes a village to support a business of this size in terms of advice and guidance that we provide. And so a lot of the functions that I'm responsible for and oversee fall into a number of different categories, including investment strategy, portfolio construction, manager research, responsible investing. Dare I say crypto falls into my world as well. I know that's a hot topic, certainly these days. We have a portfolio analytics team. We have four proprietary investment teams that do individual security selection along a few different asset classes and mandates, and then all the operational risk, legal, et cetera, underpinning the offering. So it is quite a job.
Yeah. And I would imagine lately more exciting. I don't know if exciting is a great thing or a bad thing, but it's certainly, I was thinking to myself, the 2020s have been an interesting start of a decade.
Anything but normal. That's
yeah,
for sure. Far from it. When there's no guidebook or playbook for the experiences that we're all dealing with and that the markets are trying to wrestle with, it does make for exciting and yet sometimes challenging times. I'm short on sleep, that's for sure, as a function of these last few years.
Yeah, well, I think I've aged 5 years in 2 years, so I got that going for me.
Yeah, I always joke that I'm aging in dog years. I'm a dog person, so that joke resonates with me, that I'm definitely aging exponentially. So I'm with you on that.
I just got a puppy.
You did? What kind?
A golden. She's growing very fast.
Awesome. We got a dog just about a year ago. She's going to be a year old in 2 weeks. And it was the best and the worst decision we ever made. We love her and she's absolutely horrible. She doesn't have a single manner at all. She's sweet, but she's literally terrible.
Yeah. Well, so it's like Marley and me.
Kind of. Yeah. I was hoping for a little bit more well-behaved, like a big, hairy, you know, slobbery lap dog, if you will, that would just hang out with me while I'm in here in this office doing all of this work. And she doesn't want any part of this room or me, frankly. So,
sometimes I'll bring my dog in while I'm recording a podcast. And I don't know if you see my beautiful paper shades that separates my my office from my home. Well, she started to chew those, and then she likes all the cords. So there's nothing I can do except for put her in a crate.
Yeah, so we're in the same boat for sure. Mine is about 110 pounds now.
Wow. Though,
so hopefully your puppy isn't quite that big of a giant.
That's
so.
A legit sized dog.
I didn't say what she was. She's actually a Great Pyrenees, but so it's basically like living with a polar bear slash tyrant. She keeps it interesting. We do love her. I can't trash her too much, but she has a lot of learning and manners to acquire.
Well, at 110 pounds, she can do a lot of damage too.
Yes, she can. We have found that out for sure.
Yeah, I will need to replace my floorboard or the baseboards in my house. They have become a chew toy, which has been fun
that
for no
about
one.
About right.
Yeah.
Yep. That sounds right.
There's a bear market in baseboards in my house.
There's a bull market in rawhide dog bones in our house.
There you go. Yeah, we're on the pig ear train. So.
Okay. All right.
So I guess as I like the things that you sent me, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I'd love to kind of pick your brain a little bit about how you were thinking coming into this year, how that's changed a little bit. And I know it's a really broad question, but maybe we can talk a little bit about where we are. And I know the hot topics, inflation and whatnot. So, I don't know if you want to riff on some of that.
Yeah, so we entered 2022 actually feeling pretty good about the backdrop, the underlying fundamentals, the trajectory of earnings growth, the trajectory of economic growth, at least in the U.S. for sure. And even though valuations were elevated in a number of, asset class categories, we actually felt like there was still room in the cycle, that we didn't need to make meaningful portfolio changes in response to what we were seeing. We were feeling like it was going to be a little bit of a deja vu kind of a year, not in terms of record-breaking market returns and performance like we saw in 2021, but a lot of the key themes were similar or variations on basically the same types of themes that investors have been focused on. And so, of course, all of that got turned upside down in a matter of like 30 days, maybe 45 days in total. We entered the year thinking that the Fed would do maybe 1 to 2 rate hikes over the course of 2022. It was pretty casual in terms of that maybe. We knew that they were going to shift and move away from ultra accommodative policy, of course. We knew that they were going to begin to taper the balance sheet, but the pace of change in terms of their tone and rhetoric was basically, much faster, more aggressive than what we and certainly the consensus view had been. So in a matter of a very short period of time, we feel like the world got kind of turned upside down as it relates to that. In addition, we didn't have in the crystal ball forecast Russia invading Ukraine or the pressure that was going to come into the commodity complex and energy prices in particular, from a risk premium perspective. And so it really turned into a nowhere to run and nowhere to hide kind of first quarter. And we're still certainly feeling the effects of that as the market continues to wrestle with, some of these big macro headwinds. I would liken it to a perfect storm of macro headwinds. And so, not surprising to see the market grappling with and wrestling with how to reprice this narrative as it continues to rapidly evolve here. We're thinking about 5 major headwinds at this point, right? It's global inflation sitting at elevated, sustained levels. I don't know what word to use to describe how elevated it actually has gotten, not only for the U.S., but across the globe. That's obviously having a significant impact, much more so than what we had anticipated coming into the new year. We have China's zero tolerance policy around COVID having really significant implications. So that was not part of the playbook coming into the new year that we were going to see that. And that hasn't really disrupted global supply chains. At the beginning of the year, we actually thought that that was the key to the path forward, getting some stabilization in supply chains, that that was going to be the catalyst. And if we were to get some of that settling as the global economy reopened, that that was going to be the catalyst for the market to continue its rally. Here we are in the middle of May, and I don't think we've made any progress at all as it relates to supply chains. And so that's continuing to put a ton of pressure on the system at large, and certainly inflation-related metrics. Of course, we have Russia, Ukraine, what's happening there with the energy complex, and then that pesky Fed. So, you know, we've seen really significant multiple compression just year to date. We're calling 4 or 5 multiple points of compression when you look at forward P's just on the S&P 500. Again, coming into the year, we were not banking on much in the way of valuation multiple expansion. We really felt like that was about as good as it could get in terms of valuation multiples, but that the key was going to be supply chain normalization, which would drive earnings growth. And earnings growth, all else equal, for all of these macro headwinds that are swirling, is actually still in really good shape. And Q1 earnings season coming in better than expected. So net-net, we think this is much more of a macro headwind, perfect storm-driven correction here, and not the first leg down with that recessionary backdrop looming right near on the horizon here. We think there's still room left on the clock.
How do you think through, the definition of a recession versus, like, I don't know, 2021 is a hard comp, right? So the absolute level of activity, you could have a recession, but still have like a pretty strong fundamental economy underneath that. But I think that the word recession is a very scary word. And there's just a lot of tough nuance to sort of look through in the current picture, it feels like.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, tough comps relative to last year's also an understatement. I don't know how to describe it, right? In more of an extreme way. And so, you know, the fact that we are able to continue to put up positive growth, I recognize Q1 did not come in positive territory from a GDP growth perspective, but our expectation for the full year is that we will still see that, possibly as strong as almost 2x trendline growth. So I think we need to put some of this in perspective and recognize what happened in Q1 as, you know, a function of the math. And when you look under the hood, right, the headline number never really tells you the full story, gives you the full context. When you look under the hood, I think there's a lot more there to focus on that actually matters than that's positive. And so for Q1 in particular, you know, we saw consumer spending still being really strong. We still saw business fixed investment being very, very strong. And so if those two things continue to hold up, if not accelerate from here in a very seasonally, you know, historically weak time of the year, we feel like the back half of the year is going to see some more acceleration and strength that's completely underappreciated in this environment. At the end of the day, though, the trick for investors is that we are indeed in a slowing expansion phase of the cycle. And it's always hard to not get too nervous, too bearish, too conservative, too soon, and miss out on potentially the last hurrah in, you know, the leg of the cycle or even in a bull market rally. And so we definitely think that this is another positive year of growth when you look at earnings growth and when you look at GDP growth. And so therefore, there is still time left on the clock. And even though it feels scary right now with how far markets have moved down, we actually are using it opportunistically to reposition portfolios.
It's been interesting to watch. I have obviously never lived through a period like this. I don't know if anybody has, but it's like things moved a lot faster to the upside than I thought that they would move. Especially growth has certainly moved a lot further to the downside than I thought that it would move, at least the speed at which it has. And I think that this argument of stagflation has sort of really taken off. And as somebody that missed inflation, it's hard for me to have any credibility thinking about any of this stuff, but I'm trying to learn as I go along. I don't know, like, how do you think, because you're in your seat, you're looking at a lot of different things. So how are you thinking through, like, the persistence of inflation and the slowing of growth at the same time, and what risks that may or may not pose?
Yeah, I think what I would say is that usually in a rising rate environment and in a sustained inflationary environment, we see pretty significant multiple compression, not just for the S&P 500, but across the, you know, multi-asset universe. And so that's playing out relative to historical precedent for sure. And so that is definitely informing what we think the path forward can look like. We don't believe that we are entering a period of stagflation. So that's not our base case. Our base case continues to be a slowing expansion, you know, phase of the cycle with recessionary probability picking up like in the second half of next year. I think the net effect of what we're looking at here is really that the underlying fundamentals are still strong, but slower on a relative basis. And so when we look at portfolio positioning, it doesn't pay too much in this type of uncertain environment to be really far out on the wings, to be making really significant stylistic or tactical bets. And so what we've been doing with portfolios is reducing some of those over and underweight positions, getting closer to more of the strategic baseline. It's important to stay really diversified given how volatile the backdrop is and the fact that, you know, there wasn't really anywhere to hide, especially in Q1. We had stocks down and bonds down at the same time. It's not unusual that both of those asset class categories would be down. What's unusual is the magnitude of the decline, that both are in effectively correction territory, if not more severe than that. And so we are searching for some semblance of ballast in portfolios, and the usual suspects that you would rely on, like fixed income, being that insurance policy in the portfolio, it's not necessarily what it has been historically. We're effectively at the end of a 40-year bull market in fixed income. And so perhaps it's not entirely surprising to see some of this pain as this regime starts to shift here. But I think it's really important to stay fairly well diversified across the multi-asset universe and not take really significant bets in this environment. When we start to get a little bit more clarity, or at least when some of those macro headwinds start to subside, I think the volatility backdrop will also start to settle in. We've effectively been in a high volatility regime since the onset of the pandemic, but last year investors got really conditioned, and I know I certainly did, to volatility only moving up. You know, the market just kept going up and up and up. And so we all got conditioned to, well, we're not going to see any meaningful swings. It's all to the upside. I think when you look at the S&P 500, the biggest decline last year was only about 5%, and it was really short-lived. It was only a few days. And of course, it's been the polar opposite experience this year. And I think what's even notable this year is that everybody thinks high volatility, oh, stock market, right? But actually, volatility has been much more pronounced on the fixed income side. The MOVE index, which is kind of the comparable index for fixed income to what we see with the VIX on the stock market side, is actually sitting higher than March 2020 levels. And I think that's probably not, it's surprising that we have that much volatility in fixed income, but when you think about it, perhaps not quite as surprising given how volatile the path for Fed policy, you know, Fed messaging, market-driven interest rates, you know, the whole host of issues that the fixed income markets have had to deal with this year. And then, of course, recessionary fears on top of it. So I think that's probably, I'm giving you a lot of different aspects in trying to answer your question here, but I think that's one of the most notable things this year and why investors are, you know, kind of freaked out a bit more than perhaps what we've seen in past corrections, because they don't have that ballast and protection on the fixed income side and stability that they're used to.
Do you happen to know, is there like an average duration in the MOVE index?
I'd have to go back and look. I don't know exactly what it is.
I've been thinking a lot about, you know, the saying is like, all in a real correction, all correlations go to one. I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. And it kind of makes sense because everything is competing for capital all the time. So if the opportunity cost of holding one thing is increasing relative to the other, then it would make sense that people would sell it to buy the other, and it would create sort of this cascading effect if there's net outflows on average. And I guess at the same time, theoretically, credit risk would probably be increasing, you know, in aggregate, right? So it kind of makes sense.
It does make sense. Yeah. The question is, what's everybody buying right now? Because not many things have been spared as a function of the carnage in the market on a year-to-date basis. So cash isn't really a friend right now.
Right. The only thing that it seems like is in a real bull market, commodities in the U.S. dollar.
I guess maybe, but I'm not convinced that the underlying fundamentals in the commodity complex are sustainable. I think it's totally a function of the geopolitical tensions that we're seeing. And so if by chance we get a ceasefire, if we get some kind of resolution there, not our base case, but if we do, I think that backdrop changes very quickly. I think the profitability and the margin expansion there is very fleeting. And so I would definitely be buyer beware in terms of chasing that right now.
The commodity people, I think, would say that the supply response is going to take a long time, but I have never heard a commodity pitch that says a lot of supply is coming on soon. It's almost like by definition what they say, if you're bullish, that's what you're going to say.
I don't know where the supply is coming from. It doesn't seem like anybody has any real appetite to turn on the spigot really quickly. You're not going to get a lot of policy support out of Washington anytime soon either. So we think, we thought coming into this year, to get back to your earlier question about kind of outlook coming in, we actually thought that things were going to be pretty tight in energy markets coming into this year, just because supply, has been pretty constrained. OPEC Plus has seemingly been able to get their act together meeting after meeting, which is not the norm. It's more like the exception, but, from a production agreement standpoint, they're pretty well set there. And then, a lot of interest, obviously, in alternative related energies, but nowhere near able to take over, in terms of the lead or take the batons in terms of production and energy source there. So we figured coming into this year, prices were going to be elevated, but never did we think we would see, 110 WTI as a function of, geopolitical tension. So it does seem, though, for what it's worth, in the short run, it does seem like the energy producers have definitely gotten some religion as it relates to, return on capital and profitability and all of that. But I do worry about how lasting that ultimately is.
Yeah, well, that's interesting that you have, it sounds like your bias was towards supply not growing, and yet you still are reluctant to think that it's the commodity complex will continue to run in the long term.
We were definitely, and I think still are, of the opinion in general that traditional fossil fuel usage, oil, whatever you want to describe it, is in secular decline. So yeah, that's kind of forming the opinion around supplies being constrained. At the end of the day, though, we're in a very different place because the world is awash in supply. It's just a question of whether we want to actually produce it, right? And get it out of the ground. The onset, I mean, this is not like new news, but like the onset of the discoveries around fracking in North American shale have completely changed the dynamic. We just need the will to actually produce it, and in fairly rapid fashion, to make any meaningful difference in terms of offsets here. And I'm just skeptical that in the very short run, we'll be able to move the needle. I think to the extent that this stays in place for, a fairly significant amount of time, I think we'll start to see some evolution there and some movement towards more production. But I just think it's not as easy as flipping a switch. It should be, because I think the last I checked, the break even for North American shale was somewhere in the neighborhood of $55 a barrel, right? So there's definitely room from a profitability perspective to turn that spigot on. But again, it's so hard to do this when you have a geopolitical event, or have it be event driven, as opposed to, true demand growth. I don't think demand has really even returned to pre-pandemic levels. And so I understand the complexity and the challenge with, and I think I'm just skeptical ultimately that we actually turn the spigot on and can meaningfully move the difference in the short run.
Yeah, it doesn't help that I don't think capital providers are particularly interested in funding a lot of fracking. At least, I don't know. The last time that happened, it didn't work out so well for a lot of people. So
no, it didn't. No.
Yeah. It's funny because, it's not funny. It was a silly mistake on my part, but I've read, like what Marathon's written on capital cycle theory, and here I just missed it, and it was right under my nose, but whatever. It won't be the first or last thing I miss. There will be plenty more. How do you keep all of this in your head? You cover an immense amount of breath, right? So how do you do this?
It's definitely a challenge. I drink a lot of coffee and I definitely do not sleep very much, as I think my dark circles can probably show here. It's a lack of sleep and definitely allergies given the time of year here that we're recording. But seriously though, I mean, it is a lot to capture. We're responsible for coverage, insight, you know, actionable points of view across the multi-asset universe. So that's public equities, public fixed income, and alternatives. And so it's important for me to have the perspective, you know, given all of what we need to do to support and advise our clients. And at the end of the day, I have a really strong team behind me. I'm not a one-woman show. And so trusting in the team and their, you know, significant depth of experience and expertise certainly is a key component of this job as well.
What was your career path like? You've ascended quite high.
I guess I have. I don't spend that much time thinking about it. I'll give you the long and winding road to the career path. I'm a Penn Stater. So I graduated from Penn State with a degree in finance and a minor in economics and math. Nerd alert. And I started in investment banking, realized that there was way more to life than the grueling nature of being in investment banking. That is, there was no life doing that. That was right around 2001, just to date myself.
Oh,
right.
Wow. That's an interesting time to start.
A very interesting time indeed.
What did you cover?
I was basically a generalist, but we were doing a lot of M&A related activity at the time.
A lot of pitch books, a lot of financial models.
So a lot of good training. I'll put the positive spin on it, that it was a lot of good training for the balance of my career so far. But I finally realized that there was more to life than investment banking. And so I shifted gears into equity research. Again, as a generalist, that's kind of a hallmark of my career, having my hands on a lot of different things and not getting really, really deep and specialized in one specific thing. I think it wasn't a calculated decision, but it ultimately prepared me well for future jobs. And so spent a lot of time in equity research on the buy side, picking stocks for individuals as well as mutual fund strategies, and then was a portfolio manager for a little while and a lot of time in investment strategy. And then ultimately, I shifted into this role last year when my predecessor retired. So
that's
been
cool.
A whirlwind tour through all things investment management.
I came to this through like basically studying some Buffett. And now that I actually kind of understand what he was saying, realizing how much I don't understand about what I used to think I understood. But, you know, I think if I could criticize my view of the world, it's a little too equity centric. And
oh, me too. Me too.
Yeah.
Center of the universe is all things equities. Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if that's because I think from first principles, it's the right way to be, or if it's because I'm a product of a 40-year bull market in especially U.S. equities, right? It's been a hell of a run.
It sure has. Yeah. Probably some combination of both, I would say.
Yeah, I think I was over, I went to Markel, which is an insurance company, and I was interviewing, I did a panel there. It's hard for me not to like quality equity over the long term. It's just hard for me to buy that that's not a place to generate wealth. But then I have some macro friends and they're like, how do you like equities right now? And I don't have a great answer for them, especially what's going on.
I like them better than I did at the beginning of the year. Does that count?
That does count. That counts a lot.
Given the dislocations that we've seen and the really sharp reset, but no real breakdown in the underlying fundamentals, I have to say that I like them better here. I mean, I think there are pockets of opportunity, even though it doesn't feel like it and doesn't feel like anything was really spared. I'm with you. I think large cap dividend growth in particular is very well positioned in this environment. I'm going to stick my neck out and say that I think quality growth in general growth at a reasonable price is also very well positioned. I'm going to go and say growth is the new value from that perspective, because I think there's a lot of defensiveness in those business models and strong underlying fundamentals. And so I think there's a lot of investors that are putting their eggs in the value basket, but there are some real structural issues that are sitting in the value side of the equation. And they haven't really fully recovered from the issues that were brought on by the pandemic. And so I feel like that's an area where, you know, you have to kind of turn it upside down a little bit and say, really? Growth in this environment? But I think as growth starts to get more scarce, right, as we're in the slowing expansion phase of the cycle, and as we get this valuation reset, I think investors are going to slowly start to turn to paying up for growth. So I think it's getting very well positioned here. I wouldn't be backing up the truck in QQQ or the NASDAQ 100 just yet. I think there's still potentially a bit more pain ahead there. But some of these other areas, I think you have to start fishing around in. I think there's potentially some business models there on sale.
How would you think about, and I'm not asking, I'm just asking like more theoretically, when would you think about, you know, QQQ or whatever is interesting? And the, and I guess what I'm really thinking about in my head is when growth hits a pocket, there's like such a difference between how growth investors look at investing and value investors look at investing that like the re-rating, I mean, we're seeing it right in all these growth stocks. There does not seem to be a bid. I think some of it is funds liquidating. I think some of it is just risk off. But there's definitely a fundamental point that makes sense to start buying. I'd argue it exists in some places right now, but you know, I'd be interested to hear how you've got much more experience than I do.
I'm not sure I have a great answer for you, other than to me, it seems like this just systematic re-rating, like the discount rate is moving up as a function of what the Fed is doing, and therefore those future cash flows from those growth companies are worth less. But I'm not sure that that formula necessarily holds given the environment that we find ourselves in. I mean, I think there's some truth to that. And I think there's also some truth to valuations getting really overextended, if not crazy overextended in some areas of the aggressive growth spectrum here. But I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe I'm an idealist. I think there's still runway left in the cycle. And you know, as I said before, even with a slowing expansion phase, growth is still positive. You know, if we look at it, or just for the S&P 500, earnings growth for this year is still expected to be 10% or more. And that's a pretty strong result, even in a non-pandemic year, all else equal. Forget about the tough comps and everything. That's a strong result. And that is just not being appreciated currently in this environment. I think it's just sentiment is just, you know, in the dumpster. Sentiment is just basically back to like the worst of the levels at the onset of the pandemic. And so I'm not sure that what's happening is fully rational. I think it's just, you know, this is the next phase. This is what the Fed's going to do. So we're just going to, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. There's a quote that somebody said, he goes by Skeletor on or Skelecap on Twitter. He said he had a PM that once said that when basically in bull markets, everybody's time horizon is years and years and years, right? And in a bear market, the time horizon comes tomorrow.
Yep. That's exactly what we are certainly feeling and experiencing in conversations with clients, for sure. Yep. It's an amazing shift in terms of perspective and horizon when that happens.
Yeah. So how do you talk to clients about that and kind of coach them through, hey, you know, these are long duration assets and thinking long is the answer here?
It's hard to get them to think opportunistically because everybody's like, well, what? Nothing was protective, right? There was no ballast in my portfolio. Like, why shouldn't I just pull the plug here? And I think what we try to do is come back to the goal and objective for the pool of capital that we're managing to, not losing sight of the long-term goal and objective, what it would mean to pull the plug now, you know, miss out on potentially this sharp, significant rally to the extent some of these macro headwinds start to fade here. But we also come back to our investment process. A disciplined, repeatable investment process is really our guiding light and our guiding principle in terms of gauging that path forward. And if I think if we felt really strongly that we were seeing one or more legs of that, you know, investment process stool starting to falter, we'd be telling a very different story. But our process is very much focused on the technicals, the valuation backdrop, and business cycle related analysis. There's no one silver bullet. We're not hanging our hat on one particular type of analysis. You really have to have all three working in concert to get the right context and picture for the path forward. And while the technicals piece is definitely flashing a lot of red and a lot of pain, the other two components are suggesting still runway left, still positivity, still strong underlying fundamentals, still time left on the clock. And so the technical piece is the thing that moves the most. It's the most volatile of the whole process. That's what you want from a signaling effect. But we don't see, you know, structural impairments starting to ripple into the rest of the process based on the indicators that we're looking at. And so we, even though it's been very painful and it's been, you know, a shock to the system for investors based on what we've seen this year, we keep trying to come back to what is the process telling us? And the process is still telling us that there's time left.
Yeah, I've struggled. I don't mean to make this about me, but I feel like I've been like 6 months behind, or well, maybe 6 months a little bit too punitive, but at least a month behind. And like, I keep looking for the data to crack because the market is clearly saying that the data will crack, but the data seems like I look at treasury receipts. My buddy Bill got me looking at this. So if you look at like tax receipts, the amount of tax receipts that are coming from wages and withholding taxes right now, it's crazy. Like when you comp it to 2019, it's incredible. And I guess if somebody wanted to make a hyperinflationary argument, they'd say, well, yeah, that's because labor's tight, so they're going to make more, so things are going to cost more, and you get into this spiral. But it seems to me, with real estate prices doing what they did, which is what, like, 2 years of 20 plus appreciation or something like that, stepping in and slowing this down seems to be like a very healthy process. I don't know. This seems cathartic in a way, but it certainly doesn't feel great.
It doesn't feel good, mostly because I think we've overdone it in terms of the correction here. There's no question that we need to move back from ultra accommodative policy and stimulus and liquidity being injected into the system. At some point, this economy, this ecosystem, whatever you want to call it, has to stand on its own two proverbial legs. So I'm all in on the idea of walking back from ultra accommodation, but I think we need to be very careful about how far we go, because the thing that keeps me up at night more than anything else, and believe me, there's a lot of things that keep me up at night as an investor, especially in this role, is the Fed fighting a battle that it can't actually win.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Fed is used to fighting this battle in a very hot, overheating economy. I don't think that that's where we are. We're already in a slowing expansion phase of growth.
Yep.
And so, you know, when I think about the exogenous forces that are driving up inflation, is the Fed raising rates going to do anything to energy production like we talked about earlier? Well, no. Is the Fed going to raise rates and not have any impact on Russia, Ukraine? Like, obviously not. Is it going to have any impact on COVID's situation and the zero tolerance policy that China's put into effect? No. Is it going to fix supply chains? No. I mean, it might slow down some demand to take a little bit of pressure off supply chains. But I think the Fed can only do so much with the tools in the toolbox. And so I don't know whether the Fed, you know, feels like it's fighting a credibility issue or making up for lost time or because they're behind the curve. But I do worry that the Fed just goes so aggressively here that it ultimately breaks the cycle. And in the reality, isn't actually all that effective in tamping it down. I mean, I think they can do their part. And I think if they keep going here, we can certainly end the year in a better place, a more manageable place from an inflationary backdrop. But I think there needs to be this recognition and realization that some of these other forces need to settle. And that will make a big difference in terms of the inflationary backdrop. So I want them to do a little bit more, but I don't want to go want them to go as far as what maybe the market is pricing for.
Yeah.
I think there's a big disconnect in terms of what they need to do versus what they should do here. And that's the key. If we could get some real clarity on what they're actually going to do, I think it would make all the difference for the backdrop. I mean, a perfect example of this was a couple of days ago. We had polar opposite views in the same trading day from multiple Fed governors. We had Mester saying we got to go 75 to 100 basis points. It's got to be intra-meeting. Like, we need to do this now. And then we had Waller and Williams doves at the other end basically saying 25 makes sense. Let's be data dependent. Let's recognize these other forces. And so what's a market to do when you have that kind of volatility in a narrative coming out of the same organization in one day? Like, we need to get to a one house view from the Fed. And it just feels like we're nowhere near that yet.
Yeah. It's an interesting tension between the dual mandate of pursuing full employment and tamping down inflation. Given what you're saying, like, there's an episode coming out, Jay Mintzmyer, by the time this airs, it will have come out. But, you know, he covers shipping. And his point is, like, when you get these kinks in the shipping channels, right, when China shuts down basically a city, even if the ports are functioning, the drivers can't really get to the boats. And it's any type of blockage like that sends rates, I mean, historically, through the roof, because it's like a price times volume equation. And when the volume gets so, you know, you take that much marginal capacity out, price goes through the roof. I think it's I shouldn't say everywhere. That's a broad statement, but it's a lot
it's
of
pervasive.
Different places. Yes.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Right.
It absolutely is. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you slow that down without, like, potentially breaking something more important. And at the same time, you know, I have a mother that she works hard to provide for herself, and she's, like, really, really scared about food and gas. And I don't know, you know, I feel for that group of people. I don't know what the answer is. Perhaps targeted relief, but then you maybe create more inflationary pressures. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a silver bullet kind of answer either. I mean, I think this is, at the end of the day, this is what happens when you shut the lights off on the global economy and then you try to turn the lights back on, right?
Yeah.
We haven't really experienced this. We don't have a guidebook or a playbook for how to do this in an efficient way. And so I think turning that light switch on has been a lot harder than people anticipated. And it's even to this, like, rush for demand all at once. Like, demand hasn't normalized, but we're all rushing for the same things because we haven't been able to spend on them, you know, for the better part of 2 years. And so if we could even just get a little bit of stability and normalization out of consumer spending behavior, I think it's more a function of the pandemic and the lockdowns than an overheating economy. We went from zero activity to, like, full on and then some activity to try and catch up for lost time. I think that dynamic is just really underappreciated here. I think we're being way too quick to try and, like, shut this off when there's other forces at play here. I think everybody has a role to play, I guess, is what I'm saying. I'm not sure that, you know, the Fed can solve it alone.
Yeah. Well, another buddy said, you know, try to book a plane ticket for this summer and then tell me what you think. Like, there's a couple weddings he was going to, and he was like, they could double the price of the plane tickets and I'm going to those weddings. I've waited to party with my friends for 2 straight years. Like, there's nothing that you can do that's going to stop me from going. And I think that's, I mean, every single travel and entertainment company is saying we've never seen anything like this.
But it's pent up demand, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's 2 years of not being able to go anywhere or do anything of any real consequence, and consumer balance sheets being in the best shape, you know, maybe they've ever been. I mean, we keep talking $2 trillion, you know, sitting on consumer balance sheets. What I think is interesting is, like, we're effectively in a slowing expansion phase. We're in later innings of the cycle. I don't know about you, but I have investor whiplash from it, like record-breaking cycle market collapse followed by record-breaking opening here, and we're already talking about a recession. And so I think there's just this flood of activity, this race to catch up for lost time here. I don't think this is really, you know, I don't think this is just really emblematic of, you know, a true cycle. I don't think you can really compare this to past cycles and say, oh yeah, this is exactly what we should do. There's a lot of variables here that just aren't being taken into consideration.
Do you think that some of it, some of the worry specifically of inflation, I guess, you know, when I was talking to my buddy from the macro firm, he said one of the issues that the Fed really has to fight is that, like, historically, central banks have lost credibility over inflation fights. And it puts the Fed in a real predicament because they have to break inflation. And I wonder how much of our perception of reality is driven by the fear of that combined with, like, I hate to blame it on, I'm not blaming it on social media, but I just kind of wonder how much is amplified by that dynamic. And then you get prices confirming things. And I'm a proponent of price drives narrative. I don't know. Like, have you ever seen anything like this before?
No, I mean, this is the most challenging backdrop I've seen, certainly in my career, and trying to analyze it and navigate it and make decisions about what the path forward is going to look like is really challenging. The crystal ball that's sitting behind me, I don't know if you can see it behind me, is
I do. I like
hazy.
That one.
It's definitely hazy as it relates to, you know, how to frame the path forward. I mean, I go on record all the time as complaining about the Fed. I mean, I'm inherently fighting the Fed. But in this situation, I actually feel like I'm the Fed's friend. So go figure. I'm taking a little bit of a contrarian view that, like, they need to do their part, but success doesn't necessarily mean getting to that 2% long run target here in the very short run. It's more like progress is considered success because of all of these exogenous forces. If Russia-Ukraine went away tomorrow, if China's zero tolerance policy went away tomorrow, so supply chains could normalize, I think those things would make a huge difference in terms of the backdrop and normalizing what inflation looks like for this environment. I'm not saying it's going to be two. I think the Fed still has to do its part. No, nothing about the backdrop settling is enough to call off the Fed, but I think the Fed could make some meaningful headway absent some of these forces. And so, you know, our expectation is that the Fed is going to keep chipping away at it. But the thing, as I said earlier, that keeps me up at night is that they're absolutely fighting this credibility battle, and they're just going to keep going for it to try and make up for lost time. And that's where I think we end up in a really significant problem. So I'm the Fed's friend at the moment, as long as they go at a somewhat more measured pace than what perhaps some of the more hawkish views at the Fed are suggesting right now.
Why are you on record often as criticizing the Fed?
Because I'm always like, why are they doing this? Like, what on earth? Especially back in 2018, when the Fed went on autopilot and started tightening there, I was like, that's not, they don't need to do anything here. Like, we don't need tighter Fed policy. Like, that's not the key to the path forward. There were other forces at play at that time, tariffs, concerns around, you know, free trade and all the policy changes that were coming in the equation that were freaking everybody out. That's a technical term for investors, freaking them out.
Yes.
And so I was just like, And I was just like, you know, this is not the time for the Fed to step in. Like, they should stay silent. They should stay out of it. That's not the problem here. And so inevitably, I'm just like, you know, critical of whatever decision that they're making. I mean, I'm laughing about it because it's just one of those things where it's an easy target, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that I have better information or more information or know any better. It just, it's an easy target to make judgment calls against. But this is notable in terms of me, you know, trying to support what they're doing, just recognizing that they're not going to be successful alone in this.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's complicating the issue is some of the, just the political backdrop of some of the promises that have been made on the fiscal side. And I don't even say that that's not like a judgmental, I agree or disagree. I just think that it's I mean, it's objectively what I missed is the level of stimulus relative to the size of our economy and what that was going to mean. And I was so conditioned to see velocity not increase despite my perception of money supply increasing. It was fairly obvious in retrospect to see if you're actually giving people money, they're going to spend it, and then velocity increases and then inflation, you know. But I don't know how that all plays out going forward. I mean, if I did, then we'd be having a different conversation, right?
We sure would be. I wish I had an answer for you. I don't know either, but I think it's all coming home to roost simultaneously. It's that flipping of the light switch as opposed to a gradual ramp. Like it was a shot in the arm, right? Like pun intended, liquidity coming into the system, stimulus checks, like all in one shot and a couple of doses and a booster on top of it, right? To just play off of the pandemic and all of that. And I think, you know, we're just seeing it play out all at once as the economy has, I mean, we're not even fully reopened, but as the economy has largely reopened, it's just this mad rush all at once. I think we need to work off some of that pent up demand to actually see some normalization. I don't think we need to have the Fed put the brakes on necessarily just yet. We need to see some of these other things stabilize first.
Yeah. And going back to your previous point, like it's crazy that a lot of the world is opening and then we've got a major part of the world that is shut down completely, like trying to be, you know, the zero COVID policy, like that is complicating.
Absolutely. And I think the big takeaway for me is we put all of our proverbial eggs in one supply chain basket. You know, like when you have a black swan event, a once in 100 year pandemic, you're not battle tested for what happens in that regard. And so we did see some supply chain movements early on. The low hanging fruit moved to, you know, parts of Southeastern Asia, but it was small, you know, key beneficiary places like Vietnam, but we haven't really been able to fully diversify. So to the extent that we're seeing this, you know, lockdown again here in 2022, it's having really significant impact. And I think it is going to catalyze a multi-year movement of supply chains, CapEx investment to relocate, you know, supply chains to other parts of the world to diversify. But again, you can't flip a switch and do this overnight. We're seeing it with chip manufacturers in particular, like just such an epicenter of pain with 70% of manufacturing in two companies and two countries, right? We have to diversify. We have to be better prepared when things like this happen. And so I do think that that will be maybe I'll call it a positive in terms of a positive outcome as it relates to this, that business investment, CapEx will be catalyzed as a function of this. And so I think, you know, with a lagged effect, that will be another important shot in the arm for economic growth longer term.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, when I hear that, I think, okay, well, that could put additional pressure on commodities, right? Because you're going to need to build things with CapEx, and that could put additional inflationary pressures because presumably, I mean, to the extent that it's onshored, I guess it probably goes to Mexico more than locally, but I don't know if it's domestic in the US, but that inflation would actually be associated with like true growth.
Job creation.
Yeah, which could maybe not be the worst thing in the world. I don't know.
I think it would be a positive. I'm counting it as a positive. Maybe that's my internal optimism coming out here, but I think that would be a really strong positive. And we don't think everything is going to come back to North America or the US in particular, but those things that are absolutely critical inputs, especially healthcare related, right? We want to make sure that we have an appropriate level of inventorying and supply chain management that we can control our own destiny around. I mean, clearly just-in-time inventorying did not work when you have a black swan event of this sort. And so rethinking that in addition to supply chain management, I think is really important. And I think it's going to be a multi-year phenomenon in terms of investment spend, because, you know, it takes so much time to, you know, put up a new chip manufacturing facility and all of that. So it's not going to fix it in the short run. That's not the silver bullet answer here. But I do think that will be a multi-year theme that investors can get excited about.
To what extent Do you think about private valuations in the context of public valuations have moved around so much, right? The nice thing, I make a joke a lot. I say my private valuations haven't come down at all. So that's the ballast of the portfolio.
They haven't marked to market, have they?
No.
Yep. That's a suitable replacement for fixed income. That's for sure.
Yeah. Just close your eyes and mark to model works, right?
Yep. But
how have you seen the shift in behavior to private investing? And I don't know. I've kind of opened my mind to the idea that behaviorally there may be some validity to the idea that I've heard the idea of an illiquidity premium. I used to laugh it off. I actually think it's maybe not the dumbest concept in the world.
No, we are strong believers in that illiquidity premium for sure. I mean, it moves around a lot, no matter whether it's private equity or private credit or private real estate. You know, it's not the same premium. It's not one size fits all. But we actually were spending a lot of time talking with our clients around this idea towards the end of last year of moving from pretty elevated public equity valuations into private markets. Nothing was cheap. I'm not sure that anything, with the exception of a few, you know, opportunistic ideas here, are like table pounding cheap, even with the reset that we've had. More reasonable, I think, is the way to describe it. But we do think there's still a lot of runway in private markets. So whereas it feels like maybe the cycle is a bit shorter on the public equity side, we think there's still runway left in private markets. And really, private markets are the epitome of active management. And so we think that that value that active managers and active strategies can provide, especially in this environment, are really, really valuable. And so we still think that there's a lot of opportunity in private markets, really across the spectrum. We're talking with clients about, you know, making those moves in a thoughtful way. You don't want to put all of your, you know, exposure into one particular vintage year or one strategy. So it takes time to build out a private markets related allocation. But we think the timing has been pretty good to think about shifting from public to private. And we think that will continue. We came into the year thinking that that was going to be a pretty significant theme. And I think from a flows perspective, that's borne out. I think that will continue.
The only thing that I've personally thought about that is then there's like a liquidity drag that I sort of have to manage on the other side. But that's kind of cognitive error, because it's not as if you should buy an equity thinking, oh, well, I could just sell it tomorrow, because by definition, it's a long dated asset. And then you get yourself in an asset liability mismatch potentially. So I don't know. I've got a lot of brain problems that I try to mitigate. I can't help it.
I think you're doing a good job mitigating them, yeah.
Well, I don't know. You should see what it's like internally. The amount that comes out, I block twice as much it goes on in my head. It like never stops.
Well, can you imagine how I'm feeling right about now?
No.
We're covering the waterfront of topics here. So the internal wheels are like spinning at, you know, turbo speed.
I haven't even gotten to crypto yet.
No, you haven't.
What do you think of that?
Well, we're, despite it being springtime here in the Philly area, we're definitely in a crypto winter.
Yes.
That's for sure.
And a lunar winter. See what I did there?
A blizzard, maybe. I don't know. Antarctica, something like that. yeah, it's definitely been a challenging time for crypto in general. Maybe if I just step back and talk about it kind of conceptually, where we're focused on or where we're interested, that'd be good. So we actually are really excited about the underlying technology and the innovation that might be born out of blockchain technology and the cryptocurrency, you know, industry at large. There's no question that crypto is by far the most volatile asset or set of assets on the planet. So it's definitely gone through its share of boom and bust cycles. But when you're talking about multi-trillion dollars here wrapped up in this industry, it's hard to ignore it. I think the key message that we've been sharing with our clients is you have to know what type of exposure you're getting yourself into. Because I think at last check, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of like 13,000 coins. They all do different things. They all have different use cases and business models and networks and all of that. And so if you don't really have a good sense of what you're getting yourself into, I think it's hard to frame the investable opportunity set. So is it a replacement for gold? Is it like digital gold? Is it a new method of payment system? Is it a stable coin? Is it a proxy for a central bank digital currency? You know, all of them have very different ranges of outcomes and investment opportunity sets, or in the case of stable coins, not really an investable opportunity set at all by definition. I think what's interesting about it is that it's really the next wave of innovation after effectively an innovation drought. Like the last business cycle was so long and so slow and so sluggish, below trend line growth, not much in the way of productivity enhancements. And so what's interesting is, you know, we have this new innovation here. Just because I had a fancy camera on my iPhone, you know, last cycle didn't mean that much, right, in terms of productivity enhancements. There were pockets of it. I shouldn't make a wild generalization, but I'm kind of doing it anyway. There were definitely pockets of innovation, but in general, it wasn't enough to drive like a step function change in the trajectory of growth. It's still very, very early innings for blockchain. The regulatory backdrop, I could spend, you know, the rest of our time together talking through. It's so uncertain. A lot of headwinds building on the regulatory front, who ultimately will win out or ultimately govern all things crypto. But we really think that the use cases that are ultimately born out of blockchain technology are the interesting areas for our investors to get exposed to. The challenge right now is that it's very hard to access many of these use cases or new business models, as they're mostly, you know, private markets, venture capital. It's maybe even, you know, tied up in some LP hedge fund type of strategies. And so that's, I think, why you're seeing all this fixation around the coin specifically. It's the way to access in some capacity, maybe not directly, but in some capacity, this next wave of innovation. And so broader retail investors clamoring into it, you know, trying to get access to something that in past cycles might have been just only reserved for more sophisticated or, you know, bigger capital pools in private markets. So there's a number of dynamics there. I think we're in wait and see mode a little bit in terms of how the regulatory backdrop plays out here, but really excited about use cases as it relates to the technology itself.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't know anything for real about crypto. I just know enough that I watch, but it reminds me a lot of like 98, 99, you know, like I know something big is going to come out of it, or, well, I don't know, but I will not be shocked if something very big comes out of it in the future. I just think we're a little bit early and the speculative fervor was, you know, super high. But just because, you know, 2000's crash did not disprove the thesis that what was going on would change the world, right? Right. And I think that there's a non-zero probability that what's going on right now will also change the world. I just don't know how.
I agree. I think ultimately it has the ability to revolutionize a lot of traditional processes, payment methods, services, et cetera, right? That at the heart of it, I think that's the objective. That's the motivation for many of these different types of networks and coins. And so, you know, we'll see. I'm with you. It's very early. There's going to be a lot of volatility around this, but I think it does. If done in a thoughtful way, I think it does have the potential to really revolutionize some of the more traditional approaches and processes, you know, across the economy, across the ecosystem, across the landscape. So I'm definitely an optimist and favorably disposed to the future of crypto.
So something that you said is that we were coming out of a recovery that was characterized by low productivity growth. Am I wrong in thinking that some of that productivity growth, well, I guess I would be if I kind of associate it with tech, like growing so much, but maybe I must be blocking myself. I'm just kind of wondering if in 3 to 4 years, we're back to this sluggish growth, sort of like what we came into the pandemic is what we end up out of the pandemic, but it's just going to take a while to get there.
It's possible. But you would think that additional technology investments would drive productivity.
Yeah.
Right.
Except we're and all so, on Instagram.
Exactly. Or I'm taking selfies on my fancy camera and distracting myself from all of what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting how the camera created so much value and yet didn't create any value at the same time.
A net zero? Is that what it is? I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, I like being able to share videos and stuff. I think the joy factor went up with the camera, but the amount of value that it captured from a monetary perspective, I think, is quite a bit higher than the value to society. But then again, I don't know. Society values it. So what do I know? I'm just talking in circles at this point.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, how else are you going to take pictures of what your dog destroys in your house and then share that on Instagram?
That's true. Or when she digs in a giant mud puddle in the backyard after it's been raining for 3 days here and then goes from a pure white dog to completely chocolate brown.
Right.
She definitely is on my Twitter feed.
Yeah.
Having done that. So, yeah.
So she's white. Mine's white too. I got one of these creamers.
Okay. So mine literally is a polar bear. She's pure white.
That's awesome.
Yep. Yeah.
Until they dig in dirt.
Until. Yes.
Yesterday, my kids, they get the hose and they're on this trampoline and the water below the trampoline created mud that the dog found. And that created real problems for me. Because
do you have a dog washing station, maybe?
No, we don't. No. But I think we're building a house, and I think we're going to have that. But I had just come back from a work trip, and my wife told the kid, she said, "I'm going to take a nap. Your dad's in charge." She comes down, chaos. It was not good for me.
Oh, so you're in the doghouse then?
Correct. Correct. Yes, indeed I am. So, I was at a bank and I got to ask you this question. What would you attribute your success in your career to? You know, it's not the easiest place to continue to climb the ladder. And you've navigated it.
It is definitely not. Well, I've navigated to some degree, I guess. I don't know. I think there's still opportunities ahead. But I mean, clearly, I would say that I have worked really hard to get, to where I am today. I mean, I think I don't want to underestimate how much that contributed to it. But I think in an organization of our size, fifth largest bank in the country now, you have to have strong advocates at 360 around you, supporting you. It's not just from the top down. I think that's really important. I've had people in high places advocating for me for sure over the course of my career. But I think the best scenario is when you have people below you and next to you and above you that are all cheering for you and all advocating on your behalf. And so I'd like to think that, the work alone stands for itself and that's the thing that catalyzes whatever the next opportunity is. But I've learned over time that it's much more about the relationships that you build in terms of how you can get, to whatever objective you're looking for. The work has to be there. It has to speak for itself. But the relationship aspect of the business is really important too. So I'm very grateful to have had a number of strong colleagues and mentors around me helping pave the way.
Yeah, but you deserved it. And I know it because you talked about the people below you being your advocate too. And I think that is often an overlooked insight. I think back to, I wasn't there for long, maybe 5 or 6 years or so, but some of the people that I think how they treated people below them probably put a ceiling on their career that could have been much higher, but not having the advocates among the people that worked for them, I think probably hurt. So that's very insightful.
I do think it makes a big difference. I can't say that it was necessarily well calculated on my part. It's just me being me. And I think inherently I'm more of a servant leader type of person and just kind of wired that way. And so that translates, that goes a long way in terms of getting buy-in from the people that work with you and around you. And I do think that makes a big difference. Everybody focuses on, you know, the business as being a relationship business and talking about clients, right? And building relationships with prospects. But I think the internal relationship building is also really important, if not even more so. And I think that's really been my key to success over time.
Well, my takeaway is that you're wicked smart, you're fun to talk to, you're an optimist, and you treat people well. So that seems to be a pretty good combination, to me at
least. My goodness. Thank you. I can't ask for a stronger bullet point list than that. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed interacting with you on Twitter. I'm really glad. I forget exactly how we got talking or whatever, but I was like, hey, do you want to come on? And I'm glad that we did this. I hope that you had a decent time. And
it was great. We covered the waterfront, and I hope that we get to do it again soon.
Well, you're welcome to come on anytime, but you do have to, you have to deal with my cockamamie brain whenever you come on. That's
same,
the only caveat.
I think we're kindred spirits that way, so it works well.
All right, sounds good. Well, thanks again for your time, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Me too. Absolutely.